time the wind blows puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
Well, you know it. You tell us you love it. And I've even heard you set your alarms for it. I'm talking, of course, about A Band in Manitoba, this time every week. And joining us, as always, Gordon Goldsborough from the Manitoba Historical Society. Good morning, Gordon.
Good morning, Bruce.
So tell us what the clue was from last week.
Well, I said that when we think of railways in Manitoba, we tend to think of just two, the Canadian National and the Canadian Pacific. But near Portage la Prairie, there's a small abandoned home built from materials scavenged from a third railway that operated in Manitoba in the early 20th century. And I said we would talk about it today.
How many railways in Manitoba?
Tough question to answer because there's actually lots of them. If you look at a list of the railways, but a lot of them are simply subsidiaries. They have different names.
Okay.
So if you look at just the major ones, which I would consider to be the transcontinental railways, the ones that spanned large distances, there were actually four in Manitoba in the early 20th century. Three of them were Canadian. So we have the Canadian Pacific, we have the Canadian Northern, and we have the Grand Trunk Pacific. Now, those latter two, they merged between 1918 and 1920 to form the Canadian National.
Oh, that's where CN came from.
CN. So there we have the two major Canadian ones, CP and CN. The fourth of those four, though, was something called the Great Northern, and it was quite different. Now, it's always struck me as odd that, you know, in the Canadian railway history, the major name is William Cornelius Van Horn. He was the one that pushed the Canadian Pacific through to completion, oversaw it for years. Well, Van Horn was American. And the interesting irony is that one of the big railway guys in the U.S. was a Canadian, James J. Hill. So Hill really wanted to get in on the action here in Canada. And so he was lobbying the governments to try to allow him to operate his American railway here in Manitoba. And in 1903, he succeeded. He and his counterparts at the Northern Pacific Railway convinced the Manitoba government to give them a charter to operate railways here in Manitoba. So they formed something called the Midland Railway Company of Manitoba, and the Great Northern had a 50% stake in this railway.
Midland Railway. Never heard that one.
No.
Did they build any lines?
They did. In fact, at least three of them between 1903 and 1907. Ah. So one railway went from Brandon to Devil's Lake, North Dakota. A second one went from Morden to Walhalla, North Dakota. Now, both of those railway lines, you know, they started in the early, you know, 20th century. They didn't last very long. Both of them closed in 1936, probably, you know, as a result of the Great Depression. The third line, the one that's of interest to us here today, was built between Portage la Prairie and Neche, North Dakota. And all three of these lines connected to Hill's Great Northern in the U.S. So, you know, for example, if they were going to be carrying grain, they would be loaded on an elevator here in Manitoba and then connected through to the Great Northern, and away it would go to maybe to Chicago or San Francisco or wherever. Now, another interesting dimension of this story is that the grain elevators along these lines were exclusively with one company called the McCabe Elevator Company, and that company was also based in the United States. So what we're talking about here is an American railway serving American grain elevators here in Manitoba.
And doing little hops. Like, I know Neche is close to Gretna. Does it pass through? Like, what Manitoba towns were served by this railway line?
Yeah, well, the line itself from Neche all the way to Portage la Prairie was about 75 miles in length, and there were 12 stops along it. So in the ones in Manitoba, the stops in Manitoba were, of course, as you said, Gretna would be the first one. Uh-huh. And there were other towns that probably people today would recognize. So we have Plum Coulee, Roland, Carmen, and Portage. But seven of them pretty much disappeared from the landscape. So, for example, have you ever heard of a place called Bergman or Kronsgaard or Graham, Bradburn, Magnus, Leyland? Well, in fact, maybe the most ironic one is the last one called Dunn, because very soon after the railway was built, it was done.
These are Manitoba towns?
All of them in Manitoba, and all of them gone, pretty much.
So what happened to that line?
The company spent an estimated $2 million building it. And that's to give you some idea of context. That's about $58 million today. To build this line, it was never a moneymaker for the Great Northern. So in fact, whereas the other two lines closed in the 1930s, this one built in 1906, closed in 1926. So basically only 20 years, and it lost money probably most of that time. In fact, when they closed, they had said that they had lost money successively the last 3 years of operations. Now, they did try to recoup some of their investments. So the Great Northern sold to the Canadian Pacific a 40-mile section between Carmen and Gretna, and it remained in use for decades. The CP used that line quite a long time. But the portion between Carmen and Port is La Prairie, a 35-mile portion, well, it was basically abandoned. So, for example, they took up the rails, the metal rails, and they sold them to the CP. CP, I guess, was going to use them for repairs or whatever else. Mm-hmm. The wooden bridges and trestles along that abandoned portion were sold to a fellow named Christie from Oakville. And he came and he disassembled all those bridges and trestles. He moved the pieces to a sawmill that he had at Oakville, and he cut them into dimension lumber to be used in a variety of other construction projects. But what's interesting is that a newspaper story at the time reported that the wooden ties from the railway were left in place. Now, whether it's because they couldn't find a buyer for them or perhaps they anticipated someday reinstalling the rails, I don't know. But either way, the fact that those wooden ties were abandoned is significant to our story.
How? Why?
Well, let's leap forward to the present. So back in June of this year, my cousin, Marianne Beck, put me in touch with a Dr. Robin Carter. Mm-hmm. He lives on an acreage southeast of Port of La Prairie, and near a portion of his property is the old right-of-way of this old Midland Railway line. There's a large embankment, sort of a very high sort of, well, soil pile, basically, that allowed the railway line to cross over the Elm River, which just flows just south of his property. And Dr. Carter took me and showed me where there was a number of wooden posts left over from this bridge that were still visible. Most of the embankment, though, was excavated away in the 1960s to provide fill to construct the Assiniboine River diversion.
Interesting. So what about these railway ties, these abandoned ties?
Well, so Dr. Carter has researched the history of the ownership of his property, and what he's determined is that it was once owned by Ukrainian immigrants. Now, the record's a little fuzzy, and he hasn't been able to determine exactly who it was who did this, but it was probably either a fellow named John Polichuk or George Rusnak. One of those two gentlemen built a small one-story house and barn on what is now Dr. Carter's property using material salvaged from the railway. So, for example, they basically took these wooden ties, they stacked them in piles to make the walls of the house.
Huh.
And then the exterior, well, you've probably seen in old houses, they have those pressed metal panels on the ceilings inside.
Yep.
They're crisscrossed with elaborate patterns and lines and so on. Well, they covered the exterior, covered the wooden ties on the outside with these metal panels. And you look at them and think, wow, they're really quite attractive. I've never seen them on the outside of a building,
though. Tin roof stuff.
Yeah. And,
okay.
And they've rusted, so they're sort of a golden color now. Quite attractive, actually. Mm-hmm. And underneath these wood metal panels, I see, are these stacked wooden ties that either John Polichuk or George Rusnak scavenged from the railway.
And you know that they're railway ties.
Oh, yeah. So when I was there, Dr. Carter pulled back one of these metal panels so you could see underneath. Well, if you've ever seen an old railway tie, because the railway, of course, the trains are heavy and they push down on the metal rails and it actually pushes down into the wooden tie.
Oh,
and it leaves sort of an area where the wood has been compressed.
Right.
Sure enough, pull back the metal tie and there's that compression mark. So, oh, yeah, these are very definitely wooden railway ties. On the inside of the building, what's kind of interesting, too, is they used a rather sort of a homemade system of lath and plaster. Basically took a number of branches of trees, nailed them to the sides of these wooden ties, slathered them with a mixture of wet mud and straw, let them dry to frame sort of a smooth surface, and then painted them whitewash. So, you know, I've seen that system used a lot. A lot of the Ukrainian homes.
Yeah, Ukrainian, yeah.
Yeah, but
sure.
In this case, it was on the inside, and I've never seen them using the wood like the way they did, but it obviously produced a nice smooth surface on the inside.
Green side up when you're laying sod, right? So the inside stuff went on the outside of the house, and the outside stuff went on the inside of the house.
There you go, yeah.
So how long was the house occupied?
Well, Dr. Carter's research indicates the house was occupied at least until the late 1940s or early 1950s. I tried to find out what I could about this John Polichuk or George Rusnak. Couldn't find them. I did know that the property changed hands quite a few times. So unfortunately, the trail of who actually built this little house is lost. And unfortunately, the house itself now is in very poor condition. The north part of the roof has collapsed. The floor in the main room inside has collapsed into the root cellar that was beneath it. Well, in fact, Dr. Carter is a little worried about, you know, the safety of the building, so he's planning to demolish it later this year. But he was interested in, say, sharing the story of it. And I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting one, where an old railway that only operated for 20 years, well, it's lived on in the form of this old house.
And my money's on Rusnak, or Rusnak. being the builder.
Now, Bruce, I understand that today's theme really of repurposing railway materials really resonates with you.
Yes, my home, the home I live in right now, was built in 1950, built from wood, repurposed from old boxcars. So not only was this familiar to me before when I grew up, because my grandfather would buy used boxcars, and he and my dad and my uncles would take them apart, hammer the nails out of them, and resell the wood, because it's very, I don't know if it's kiln, I can't remember the details, kiln dried or pressure treated or something, and so solid. The house I live in now, built by a guy named Peter Rudick, is you go up in the attic, you see serial numbers stenciled on the wood. The garage frame, you go up and look at the rafters of the garage. I can't make out if it's CP or CN or whatever, because all I see is mostly little parts of letters and numbers. And the subfloor in my house is built with old railway wood, and it's a 70-year-old house. And there's not a creak in the floor.
Yeah.
Not a creak anywhere in the house. Like, that's all. My point is, that's very, very solid wood. Great for building.
Well, now it makes me wonder then, how many other buildings out there are made from repurposed railway material? So
probably tons, and all built by Ukrainians, of which I claim some heritage. Yeah.
Well, there's a challenge. If any listeners know, maybe you should give us a call.
Thanks, Gordon. That was very interesting. What's a clue for next week?
Well, I'm going to be on the road next week, and I'm on the search for more historic sites.
Right.
And I'm going to talk about a place in western Manitoba that speaks to the skills and interests brought here to Manitoba by Italian immigrants, and specifically one named Lorenzo Sarginia.
Equal time for our Italian friends. Thanks a lot, Gordon.
See you next week.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba. Many moons.